Okay, we're going to read today from 2 Kings, 2 Kings, chapter 6, verses 8 to 18, and that's on page 425 if you're using the church Bibles. Okay, in this passage in the NIV, it refers to the king of Aram, so Aram was really the same as Syria, and later on I'll be probably talking about Syria, so when you hear Syria, it's the same as Aram. Now the king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, "I will set up my camp in such and such a place." The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware of passing that place, because the Arameans are going down there." So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king, so that he was on his guard in such places. This enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, "Will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel?" "None of us, my lord the king," said one of his officers, "but Elisha the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom." "Go find out where he is," the king ordered, "so that I can send men and capture him." The report came back, "He is in Dothan." Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. "Oh my lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "O Lord, open his eyes so that he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. As the enemy came down towards him, Elisha prayed to the Lord, "Strike these people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. Elisha told them, "This is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man you are looking for." And he led them to Samaria. After they entered the city, Elisha said, "Lord, open the eyes of these men so that they can see." Then the Lord opened their eyes, and they looked, and there they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he asked Elisha, "Shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them?" "Do not kill them," he answered. "Would you kill men you have captured with your own sword or bow? Set food and water before them, so that they may eat and drink and then go back to their master." So he prepared a great feast for them, and after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away, and they returned to their master. So the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory. Amen. God will bless the reading of his word. Our theme today is seeing and knowing, at least that's what I've called it. And seeing things and knowing things is a normal part of what it means to be human. Animals can be very intelligent, but generally they aren't interested in watching the news or reading books. Many people, of course, aren't interested in those things either, but we are all interested in seeing and knowing things one way or the other. And so we have in our world TV and radio, newspapers and magazines, social media and the internet generally. Never in the history of the world has so much information been so readily available, literally at the tips of our fingers. In the passage we read today, we're going to learn some things about seeing and knowing. They're not things that we don't know already, but just we're going to remind ourselves of them. And in the first place, we see what we're talking to Samuel about, that God sees and knows everything. And we can see this in the rather amusing incident with the king of Syria in 2 Kings 6, verses 8 to 12 that we read. But before we come to our passage, maybe just remind ourselves a little bit of the history, to put this in the historical context. At this time in ancient history, the people of God were largely confined to the nation of Israel. And the nation of Israel was made up of the descendants of the 12 sons of Jacob. So we have, from those 12 sons, we have the 12 tribes of Israel. And under King David and King Solomon, they had been formed into a great nation when those two kings had reigned over them. But then when Solomon died, the kingdom was divided. And the southern part was made up of two tribes, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, and normally referred to as Judah. And they had their own kings. And then you had the northern part made up of the other 10 tribes, and they were usually referred to as Israel. And they had different kings ruling over them. And in the passage that we read from 2 Kings, it was the northern kingdom of Israel that was in focus. The northern kingdom of Israel had, to a large extent, turned its back on the true God and on worshipping him in the way that he had commanded. There was much worship of false gods, such as Baal, and even those who were trying to worship the true God weren't doing it in the way that God had commanded. All the kings of the northern kingdom were bad kings, and they encouraged their people in their disobedience of God. And because of that, God was angry with his people, but in his mercy he sent prophets to them, prophets to call the people back to himself. And prophets in the Bible weren't just people who men who predicted the future, but they were spokespersons of God. God spoke to them, and they then spoke to the people. They brought God's message to the people. They were God's mouthpiece, if you like. And the most prominent prophets in the books of 1 and 2 Kings are Elijah and his successor Elisha. And these men spoke out bravely for God, and God did many wonderful things through them. And we can read the details of those things in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. In our passage, the passage we read today, the man of God who is in focus is Elisha. And so when it refers to the man of God, it's Elisha that it's referring to. So if we turn back to our passage then, we see that because of the people of Israel had turned their back on God, God had sent various enemies against them. And at this time, in this particular chapter, the enemy concerned was the nation of Syria, or Aram, as it is in the NIV. And Syria was to the north and to the east of the land of Israel, in the same place as the land of Syria is today that we've heard about so much in recent years. And at this time, the king of Syria is not carrying out an all-out war against Israel, but he's sending raiding parties into the land of Israel. But if you look at verse 11, we see that he's getting very frustrated, because he finds that whatever plans he makes with regard to moving his men here or camping there, he finds that the Israelites seem to know his every move and are one step ahead of him. And he comes to the conclusion that some of his servants must be leaking the information to the king of Israel. He thinks there must be a spy in the camp amongst his advisors, a spy who's telling the king of Israel exactly what the Syrians are going to do next. We, of course, know exactly what's happening because we read in verse 9 what is happening. It's Elisha, the man of God, who's passing on the information to the king of Israel. And the king of Syria's servants seem to know this as well, because they tell the king that it's not one of them who's leaking the information, but it's Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, who tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. I'm sure they were quite happy to pass the buck as well, because I'm sure if they had been found guilty of passing secrets, they wouldn't have been surviving very long. So they are quite happy to tell the king that it's Elisha, the prophet, who's the problem. We shouldn't, of course, imagine that Elisha has some sort of bugging device in the king of Syria's home, or that he has a spy amongst the king's servants. No, it's God who sees and knows everything, who knows the plans that the king of Syria is making, and he passes on these plans to Elisha, who then passes them on to the king of Israel. God sees and knows everything. Absolutely nothing escapes his all-seeing eye. He knows absolutely everything about everyone who is here today, about every action we have ever done, every word we have ever spoken, every thought we have ever thought. And he knows that about the future as well. Every word we ever will speak, every action we ever will do. It's a mind-blowing thought, but it's true. And this is the God that we meet to worship today. We sung earlier from Psalm 139, which again speaks about God being present everywhere and knowing everything, even our very thoughts, before we think them. This truth about God should be a very encouraging thought for those who love him, because it means that nothing can ever happen to us about which he is not aware. Sometimes if we're going through some particular difficulty, we're tempted to think that nobody really knows or understands what we're experiencing. But we can never rightly say that, because the Lord always knows everything that is happening to us. And he doesn't just know it in a distant sort of a way as a fact. He knows it by personal experience, because in the person of Jesus Christ, he has suffered all the kinds of suffering that we, his people, suffer. Are you suffering pain today? Well, he suffered agony of body and mind in Gethsemane and on the cross, at a level above and beyond anything that we will ever suffer. Are you feeling let down by others? Well, his best friends deserted him in the hour of his need. And one of his inner circle even denied that he knew him with oaths and curses. Do you feel yourself to be the victim of injustice? Have you been treated unfairly in some way? Well, Jesus, more than anyone before or since, knew injustice. We could multiply examples, but we can surely say that whatever we are going through, he knows, and he knows by personal experience. Now, that in itself wouldn't necessarily be a comfort to us, knowing that God knows our troubles, if we thought he didn't care about them. But the truth is that he does care about all that his children have to face, and he has promised to be with us in our difficulties, and that our difficulties will not ultimately destroy us. There are great words in Isaiah 43, verse 2, which are an encouragement to God's people. It says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze." So for God's people, the fact that God knows all about us is a comfort. It means that we will never have to face anything on our own. But the fact that God sees and knows everything about us is not just a comfort, but it's also a cause for concern. For it means we can never hide our sin from God. He always sees and knows our thoughts. He sees everything that we think and say and do. As Hebrews 4:13 says, "Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of him to whom we must give account." Knowledge of this truth should mean that we never try to conceal our sin from God, but rather confess it and seek his forgiveness. Perhaps there could be someone here today and you're not yet a Christian and you're foolishly thinking that you can fool God about your sin, convince him that you're good enough to be allowed into his kingdom based on your own goodness. Or maybe you're convinced that it's okay to keep on doing something that you know is wrong because you think nobody can see you. Well, don't be foolish. God sees and he knows everything. Okay, moving on. Secondly then, we see that while God sees and knows everything, we see that God's people don't see and know everything. God's people don't see and know everything. We see this in the experience of Elisha's servant in the passage that we read. The king of Syria is furious when he hears that Elisha is the cause of his problems. And Elisha is the one who's passing on the information to the king of Israel and preventing him achieving what he wants to achieve. And so in anger and in a massive overreaction, he sends a huge army to get Elisha. And he hears that he's in Dothan, so he sends this great army of horses and chariots and soldiers to get this humble prophet. And Elisha in Dothan is in Dothan, and the Syrians come by night and surround the city with their large army. And Elisha's servant gets up early in the morning and goes outside and looks around, and he gets the shock of his life because he sees this great army surrounding the city. And immediately he thinks, and he automatically assumes that this is it. They're going to be annihilated. And he cries out to Elisha's master and he says, "Alas, master, what shall we do?" I'm sure if we had been in that situation, we would have acted very similarly. But Elisha is very calm, and he says, "Don't be afraid, because those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Don't be afraid, because those who are with us are more than those who are with them." I'm sure the servant must have thought Elisha was out of his mind. He could see the huge Syrian army surrounding them, and he could see him and Elisha standing there, all two of them. Elisha then prays, "Lord, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the eyes of the servant, and he sees the mountain full of horses and chariots of the Lord are afire all around Elisha. These were the armies of heaven, the angels of God surrounding Elisha and his servant to keep them from being harmed by the Syrian army. They couldn't have been in a safer place. Elisha could see that. He could see, but at first the servant couldn't see until God opened his eyes. Roger Ellsworth, in his commentary on this passage, says there are two parts to reality. There's the part that we see, and there's the part that is hidden from us. There are two parts to reality. There's the part that we see, and there's the part that is hidden from us. Initially, the young man saw the Syrian army. They were real enough. He could see them. He could probably see the early morning sun glinting off the spears and their swords. He could hear the snorting of the horses and the rumble of the chariots and the shouting of the soldiers. They were very real to him. However, he didn't see the hosts of heaven surrounding them in far greater number and far greater power. They were just as real, every bit as real, but he wasn't able to see them initially. And isn't that what happens to us too? Those who are God's people have many privileges. Our eyes have been opened to see many things. We see, first of all, that we have sinned against a God who requires a perfection. We have seen that we can't sort out our sin problem ourselves. And we have seen in Jesus Christ the perfect answer to our problem. So we have seen many things and many very important things. But like this young man, we often don't see the whole picture. Perhaps you lose your job and you see the reality of your decreasing bank balance. You see the frustration of applying for job after job without success. And you seem to be getting nowhere. But there's another part to the reality that you maybe don't see. And that might be that God is teaching you lessons that you would never learn when things were going well. Perhaps he's teaching you to depend more on him and put less trust in material things. Or maybe you're struck down by a serious illness and you see very much the reality of that illness and the frustration of the things that you can no longer do, the reality of the weakness and the pain and not being able to carry on your life as you would like to. These are all very real and you can see them. But again, there's another part to the reality that you don't see. And again, that is what plans God has for you in that illness. And they are good plans to cause your faith to grow in ways that would not be possible if that illness hadn't come into your life. Maybe he's teaching you patience. Maybe he's preparing you so that you can sympathise with others in the future who go through similar suffering. And you can't sympathise really with someone unless you've been through the experience yourself. So we can apply this principle to whatever trial or difficulty might come our way. We don't see and know everything. So we must always remember that the bit that we see isn't the whole story. God is in control and he's working out his purposes in our lives, even though we can't see at the time how or why he is doing that. We are called as Christians to live by faith, not by sight. This has always been the case for God's people. It was the case when Jesus was crucified. His disciples saw him dying in shame. They were devastated and disappointed because they had such high hopes of what Jesus was going to do, and now those hopes seem to be dashed. When Jesus rose from the dead and met up with two of his despondent disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him. They weren't expecting him. After all, they thought he was dead. And as they talk, they tell Jesus about the events which had taken place and how Jesus had done many wonderful things, but then that the rulers of the people had crucified him. But they had been hoping that it was he who was going to set Israel free. They were disappointed in Jesus. They felt at that point that he hadn't delivered the goods. But they were only seeing part of the picture. They hadn't seen that God had raised him from the dead, and that through his death and his resurrection, God was doing something wonderful for all of his people, far greater than setting Israel free. He was setting all of his people free who lived all down the ages. So as we live our lives, we need to remind ourselves that even as Christians, we only see part of the picture. We need to live by faith, not by sight, if we're going to avoid being discouraged by many of the things that we face. So we've seen that God sees and knows everything. God's people don't see and know everything. And finally, we see that those who are not God's people don't really see anything. Those who are not God's people don't really see anything. If you have not yet trusted in Jesus Christ as the only way of being right with God, then the Bible's verdict on your eyesight is that you haven't got any, that you're spiritually blind. In the passage that we read, God afflicts this great Syrian army with blindness at the prayer and answer to the prayer of Elisha. so that Elisha, the humble prophet that they came to capture and take away, ends up leading them, a whole army blinded by God, right into the very heart, into the capital of Israel, the enemy. What a wonderful picture that is of the futility of resisting God. Governments and powers continually try to resist God, but this shows us the total futility of resisting God, because here was one servant of God against a whole army, and God just turns the whole thing completely around, and the prophet leads them by the hand into the capital of the city of the capital of Israel. And this is a picture of the army blinded by God. It's a picture like what we're all like by nature. If we haven't yet turned away from our sin and trusted in Christ, we are spiritually blind. What does it mean to be spiritually blind? When a doctor is seeking to diagnose a disease or condition, they look for the signs and the symptoms. What are some of the conditions of spiritual blindness? Well, firstly, I would suggest that a spiritually blind person doesn't see that they are in need. They don't see that they're a sinner who has offended a holy God by their thoughts, by their words, and by their actions. Generally, a spiritually blind person thinks that they're not too bad. In the second place, they don't realize that they can't do anything to make themselves right with God. In fact, often they think that God's bound to actually be quite pleased with them, because after all, they've never done anything really bad. And compared to some people, particularly some Christians they could name, they're an awful lot better. And finally, a spiritually blind person can't see any value in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as God offers him as a perfect answer to their greatest need. They perhaps acknowledge that he's a great teacher or a great leader, but they can't see that he is the one who God has sent as a sacrifice for sin to deal with their greatest problem. How tragic. The cure for the deadly disease that we all suffer from is available for the asking, but those who are spiritually blind don't even realize that they need it. Could that be you today? Could that describe what you're like? If that is your situation today, then you need to cry out to God to open your eyes so that you might see the danger that you're in, and that he would help you and provide for you. Perhaps God is in the process of opening your eyes. Perhaps you're beginning to understand that sin is your greatest problem. Perhaps you're beginning to understand that Jesus Christ is the answer to that problem. Well, if that is the case, then cry out to him even more that he would continue that process and open your eyes fully to see that Jesus is the answer. And then God will be merciful, just like he was merciful to this blind army, and he opened their eyes and he caused them to sit down to a feast. If you cry out to God today, he will open your eyes and bring you into his kingdom through the work of his Son. Amen.